Today on Conflict, is consensus conceivable in Congress? Good afternoon. It's Tuesday, November 18th, 2003. And coming to you live from WGMU in George Mason University, Fairfax, Virginia, this is Conflict.
We cannot learn from one another until we stop shouting at one another, until we speak quietly enough so that our words can be heard as well as our voices.
And welcome to episode 11 of Conflict on WGMU and George Mason University. This is where we continually explore effective, nonviolent, non-adversarial, and collaborative approaches to addressing conflict in our personal lives, our communities of all sizes, and our world. Today, we will learn about a fascinating new plan to create a consensus process for the United States Congress. Here with us in the studio to help us explore the ins and outs of what may soon be known as the United States Consensus Council is the director of the National Consensus Initiative, Rob Fersh. Mr. Fersh is no stranger to efforts to building common ground among contentious parties, and he is also no stranger to government affairs. For nearly three decades, Mr. Fersh has served in a range of leadership roles with elected members of Congress and nonprofit organizations, all dealing with American public welfare. Mr. Fersh has witnessed the challenges that Congress faces with making tough decisions within the bounds of such an adversarial political environment, yet he also has witnessed the sincere desire held by so many politicians who truly do want to make a difference and want to do what's best for the people of the United States. It is my distinct pleasure to introduce to you Mr. Rob Fersh. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Sean.
Let's just start off, and I know there's a lot of people tuning in because they're interested in this United States Consensus Council idea, which has been certainly if you're involved in the conflict resolution community, it's something that has been getting some more notoriety, attention through organizations such as the Association for Conflict Resolution, and there have been some articles on it, and there have been some other outlets as well for the information. But today is a chance to spend an hour and really focus on just understanding, kind of in layman's terms, for those who might not be, you know, conflict resolution professionals, but just anyone out there who just want to understand what's this idea all about. So if we could start just by explaining this notion of the term a consensus council. What is that?
Well, in this context, what we're talking about is a place that Congress would actually establish, it would authorize and even fund, a place where it could send certain issues where it wants help in terms of finding good public policy solutions. It's modeled, Sean, on a series of state-level consensus councils that have been successful. And in fact, one of the founders of a state consensus council in Montana is helping to lead the drive at the national level to create the U.S. Consensus Council. And in a nutshell, here's the idea. The idea is that when Congress faces certain issues that either are so polarized as to be gridlocked or potentially so complex that it cuts across jurisdiction, and it's having trouble finding solutions that work to the benefit of large numbers of people, it could use an organization like the U.S. Consensus Council, which will be have staff and other people working for it who have great expertise in finding common ground and building consensus. It could send that issue over, and if after a careful assessment the Consensus Council thinks it's a good issue it could take on, then the Consensus Council would gather all the major stakeholders and try to engage in a process of building trust amongst the parties, identifying the differences, and eventually trying to find areas of agreement where people from across the spectrum on a particular issue might come to common ground, might come to agreement, and if they do so, then that would be the basis of some recommendations back to Congress for action.
Now, I'd like to, in a little while, get into the specifics of what that decision-making process might look like. But first of all, could you paint a little more detailed picture on who this really is? Would this be members of Congress actually sitting around coming to consensus? Would this be, you know, their delegates? Would this, you know, say a little more about who really is this?
Well, I think the model that we envision, and of course this may change with the reality, is the model used at the state level. And basically, one needs to consult with the key members of Congress who are leaders on a particular issue. But ordinarily, it's not members of Congress sitting around a table. It would be the key stakeholders from across the political spectrum. So we would want to make sure we had a very inclusive process, bring in people from all different points of view, and maybe some other people who are just experts in the field or have knowledge that would help inform a process, and have them spend some time getting to know each other, mm-hmm. understanding the issues, and out of that level of understanding, potentially find agreements that would not otherwise be possible in the normal range of business and the normal workings of Congress. As you mentioned, I actually worked on the staffs of three congressional committees, and often they're very rushed. They're under a lot of pressure, limited time. It's often a fairly adversarial atmosphere, although there are many members of Congress who work very well across the aisle with other people. And the idea here is, especially on certain complex issues, sometimes you just need to have people spend enough time to understand the wisdom that various perspectives can be brought to bear. So this is anything, you know, this can be described as anything from a conflict resolution or a kind of a large mediation process. Other people have called it like a Manhattan Project, where sometimes there are issues where everybody's got a piece of the puzzle and they're never in the room at the same time to really hear each other and collect each other's wisdom into what may be a solution that, you know, is not otherwise possible unless you bring those people together.
Now, are there not any other processes currently within the United States Congress that do anything similar? For instance, even if it's from one side of the aisle, are there not processes that convene, you know, task forces or, you know, committees on various issues to explore the merits of different ideas?
Well, you know, Sean, everything's on a continuum. Yeah. And there's some committees within Congress that operate on a very collaborative basis, and there's a lot of cooperation, and in many cases people from different political parties don't have that much disagreement and they work very well together. Then there are other issues in which, frankly, everyone's at loggerheads and it's always a battle, and one year that passes 51-49 in the Senate and the next year it goes the other way. And there are many times not time to do these processes adequately. Your question, actually, I think probably the closest thing to what you're getting at in your question is this. Periodically, there's some issues that are so sensitive or so difficult that either through the White House or through Congress, a special task force or commission gets set up. Mm-hmm. Years ago, they did one chaired by Alan Greenspan on Social Security, which was seen as successful. There have been other ones on Army base closings and other issues that have been less successful. President Clinton tried to start one on race. And what we're saying basically is that rather than reinvent the wheel each time there's a tough issue and be left to kind of an ad hoc basis, who gets to staff this out, who gets to think it out, people who don't have necessarily have skills at building agreements, maybe staff in the effort, why not create an entity that takes advantage of people of great skill and talent who understand how to build consensus and agreement and apply it to a variety of issues? So there's an institutional memory about how to build agreements on tough issues. What happens even when a commission like Greenspan's operates and it was successful, well, once it's done its job on one issue, it disbands. So all the knowledge and wisdom of how to do this process right is lost when it goes away. Mm-hmm. So we're looking to create an ongoing institution that could be used on a variety of issues. And the people mediating or conducting the sessions may vary depending on the issue. It may be that if it's a very technical issue, you need to bring a mediator or a facilitator who really understands those issues in depth. But the U.S. Consensus Council would try to match up the right people to the right processes.
Now, can you give me any examples? I know earlier on, before the show, you mentioned some other consensus processes at the state level that have been successful. Could you give an example of an issue that has been addressed using this process?
Sure. Probably the granddaddy of all the state consensus councils is in North Dakota. And the issue, I think, that basically got them started, there were a couple of key issues, but one was there was a tremendous disagreement about end-of-life care in North Dakota. And, in fact, there was one particular woman who was on life support, and there was a great debate whether, in fact, you know, the plug could be pulled on her because there was, apparently, as I recall, there wasn't much evidence that she would have any quality of life continuing. And there was a great dispute about that. It was in the courts. It was in the legislature. There was no resolution. And finally, all the different stakeholders with different points of view were pulled together to try to create a policy which would help guide when end-of-life care would be sustained and when it would not. And over a period of, I believe, about 2 years, people met and eventually worked out an agreement. And what people, part of the process, said was so remarkable was not just that they reached the agreement, but they really began to understand each other. People who they were diametrically opposed to before they came in, they began to see them not just as positions and or as ideologues, but began to see them each other as full human beings. And they devised a process that apparently still guides, a series of legislative recommendations, still guides policy in North Dakota. And there are other models in Montana. There have been a series of successes getting ranchers and environmentalists to often disagree strongly to sit down at the table. In fact, one of those ranchers in Montana is the former lieutenant governor of Montana, Denny Rehberg, who now represents Montana in the House of Representatives, and he is the lead sponsor in the House of Representatives of the legislation to create the United States Consensus Council.
And the person who created the Consensus Council in Montana is involved with this as well, correct?
That's correct. The co-chair of our task force to create the U.S. Consensus Council is Mark Rusko. He was former governor of Montana. The Consensus Council was formed under his watch. People may have seen his name a lot in the papers the last few years because he, as governor, became a close friend of then-Governor George Bush. And once he came to Washington a couple years ago, shortly thereafter, President Bush asked him to be chairman of the Republican National Committee, and he's now chairing the president's re-election campaign. But throughout his efforts on that, he continues to work very hard to create the United States Consensus Council. And he's matched up with, as the co-chair of our task force, is former congressman and former Secretary of Agriculture under the Clinton administration, Dan Glickman, who now runs the Kennedy Institute on Politics at Harvard. And Dan Glickman and Mark Rusko have assembled an eminent bipartisan task force who may not necessarily agree on a lot of political issues, what the country ought to do, but they really agree that there can be, as a complement to current processes, not to replace how Congress works on most issues. Congress doesn't have the time or energy and money to put together a consensus process on every issue, and it wouldn't be efficient. But on selected issues where there really are disagreement and people are not making headway, they, Dan and Mark and everyone else on our task force, think it would be great to have another tool available to help resolve tough issues the country faces.
Mm-hmm.
And this could be any issue. It could be the issue of health care in this country, or a series of education issues, environmental issues, even issues about foreign aid and what's our role in the world. To the extent there's disagreement and we cannot otherwise work out solutions that optimize our public policy, the U.S. Consensus Council represents a potential additional forum in which disagreements can be worked out, and then recommendations can be brought back to Congress, which Congress can accept, reject, or modify. There's no force of law for anything that would happen within the U.S. Consensus Council.
So whatever comes out of a Consensus Council proceeding is, in essence, an advisement to those who actually have the authority to make the decisions in Congress.
Right, Sean. That's a very important point. One of the objections we often hear, and I think it's legitimate concern, is, you know, who is this group? Are they usurping the role of Congress? We elect people to make decisions in Congress. Well, the truth is, Congress all the time takes advice from outside parties. And sometimes members of Congress even say to people who are fighting over issues, would you go off and see if you can work this out? If you two can work out something, I'm going to be quite interested. Well, here we're simply saying, okay, because Congress doesn't always have the time to do this well, because oftentimes hearings in Congress are set up with one side getting their witnesses and they argue their side and the other side argues their side, and there's really not a chance for dialogue, that in certain instances getting people around a table over time and allowing them to make some recommendations should they reach a consensus, we think that would be valuable. And Congress, it's totally up to Congress whether they want to accept those recommendations. The way it's worked at the state level is that if people do a great job getting the right people around the table, that is, if a consensus council makes sure that it really is inclusive and gets all the major differing points of view represented, if you reach consensus, those recommendations usually have a powerful sway with legislators of all parties, and the legislation that emerges in many cases passes overwhelmingly. So you have a situation where there's much broader buy-in to solutions. In many cases, the solutions appear to be wiser and more enduring than might otherwise have occurred. Not always the case. It sometimes doesn't work, but it often has been the case.
Presumably because they took into account the multiple stakeholders' viewpoints.
Yeah. That's correct. I mean, the idea of this is also to find the highest common denominator solutions. It really doesn't work if it's some half-baked compromise that nobody really believes in. That's not going to fly because even the stakeholders aren't going to want this to go forward. The idea is to find solutions that kind of transcend yet include the various points of view in a way that everyone agrees this is better than the status quo and worth doing. That's the goal.
Now, you mentioned a little while ago some examples of issues that might be addressed with this process. And I could certainly imagine that a lot of folks out there would see no problem with it. If we can find ways to come to agreement, whether it's consensus or not, if we can find a way to solve this problem, so to speak, and this is a process that's helpful for that, then great. But are there any issues for which this process you think may not be appropriate?
Oh, yeah. I think there's lots of issues. And I think the important thing is once an issue, let's say, gets referred to the Consensus Council by Congress or otherwise is presented to them, I think you have to do a careful assessment. If, in fact, the major stakeholders won't come to the table because they think they're going to do better by holding out, then it's very difficult to have that process go forward. If the decision makers aren't going to really heed the results of a consensus process, then you wouldn't want to go forward either. But sometimes you'll get people to the table because, let's say, the bipartisan leadership of a couple of congressional committees might say, we're really going to pay serious attention to what comes out of this process. That might get a recalcitrant stakeholder to come to the table. There are other people who, for reasons of complete principle, feel that they can't come to the table. They're afraid they're going to have to relinquish their values or be compromised too much. That's not what the process is about. The process really is about consensus and having people of all different stripes hopefully find the common ground. But there's a lot of reasons why some issues wouldn't work. And I want to say I think there also are limits. For instance, on the issue of abortion, I doubt you could put people around the table to agree on whether or not abortion should be legal. That's such a deep-seated issue of principle and values for people one way or another that I don't think you can get agreement on that. On the other hand, there's been some experience of success getting people on both sides of that issue to talk about alternatives to abortion. How about adoption or pregnancy prevention? And again, those are difficult issues. Not everyone can reach agreement. But there are times when you can move off central, deeply held principled issues and solve some corollary issues that are very important.
If I understand, the real goal there is to find the overlapping values, right? To find, even if you have some, two sides who are fundamentally opposed on an issue like abortion, you find that they do have many values in common. And it's that that you work,
yes.
You work with.
Yeah, I mean, from my experience, and as some people differ about this, my experience isn't that people's values differ so much. I think you often find people of diametrically opposed views who have very common values. It's just they have a different view of how to implement those values. And so in the parlance of conflict resolution, you need to have them move off of their positions and look at their underlying interests and see then how it might be ways to have their values be met by a series of policy recommendations. I think it's very important. And, we recently had a conversation with Sarah Cobb of ICAR here, that, this is a place where people's moral values should get expressed strongly and people should put out their views strongly. And if you are curtailing your point of view just in order to reach agreement and you end up with agreements that really don't satisfy people deeply, then they won't be enduring.
Right. So this not about compromise.
Although there's room for compromise. I mean, mm-hmm. For me, compromise is not a dirty word. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people who will compromise on issues where they can, especially if they think compromise is a better solution. You need to be pragmatic. What's better is better. But I think fundamentally the most important thing is to make sure you clarify the differences, have a full and open conversation, and hope then you find solutions that satisfy people as fully as you possibly can, not just sort of half-baked solutions that, sometimes as a matter of political expediency, we solve problems halfway in Congress, and it's understandable. And I've been part of that as a congressional staffer. But I think there are times when you can have deeper conversations and have longer lasting and wiser solutions if you can go deeper into the conversation amongst people who disagree.
Now, the House has already appropriated $1 million for this, as I understand it, subject to enacting a law. With, you know, maybe you got to describe the process a little more. But from what I understand, there's been money appropriated, yet it's now the bill is on the Senate floor, waiting to be voted on.
Yeah, roughly correct. What we have, and it's convoluted, and frankly, it's even hard for me to understand it, and I've been through the process for many years. Yes, as part of an appropriations bill that passed last January, there was a $1 million earmark for the United States Consensus Council, actually put into the conference report on that appropriations bill, that said that money became available to start up the U.S. Consensus Council once the bill, underlying bill that actually authorizes its creation is passed. So it's backwards from where it normally works in Congress. Normally you get some program authorized, then you have to fight tooth and nail to get it funded. We got it funded, but it's subject to an authorizing bill passing. And we had been optimistic that bill would pass this year, but there's limited time left in this Congress. The bill did pass in June through the Senate Committee on Governmental Affairs. The lead sponsor in the Senate is Senator Susan Collins, and she's the chairman of the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee. And the bill went through unanimously, and it was reported out. And then it went to the Senate floor, and we've been facing a situation where a small bill like this, in their eyes, it's a big idea, but a small bill. Mm-hmm. We've been trying to pursue a strategy of unanimous consent consideration on the Senate floor, which means that any senator can raise an objection or put a hold on the bill. And right now there is one hold was raised, and that was worked out, and now another hold has been placed on it. And we're optimistic that once people really understand what this bill is about, that'll be lifted. But it's being held up on the Senate floor right now, but hopefully we'll get it through. And then of interest, I think, to people at GMU is this. When the bill moves to the House side, it has to go through the House Committee on Government Reform. And the chairman there is Representative Tom Davis, our own representative here at GMU. And he has indicated a positive response to this idea thus far. So we're optimistic that if we get the bill through the Senate initially, and we hope that will happen soon, then we hope we'll get a favorable hearing and opportunity for action on the House side with Representative Davis helping to lead the way.
So if this goes through the Senate, it's going to be essentially a consensus that outcome for the Senate to approve this, correct? So isn't it a bit ironic that perhaps what may be holding it up are some folks who perhaps are not talking about why they don't want to approve it?
Well, I don't know if it's ironic. I think part of it you just have to adjust to the fact that there's hundreds of pieces of legislation in Congress, and there need to be checks and balances, and it shouldn't be easy to pass legislation through as even ideas as meritorious as this one. And what we found is that people, and I respect this a lot, people watch the legislation carefully to make sure that legislation that may appear to be inconsistent with their values doesn't go through. And even though we had a committee study it quite carefully and pass it, there's some members who I think need to know more about the U.S. Consensus Council. Some are concerned about any time there's a new program that smacks the government. This would be a private nonprofit, but funded and authorized by Congress and with a board appointed by Congress and the President. So anything that's a new government program, you know, rings a bell for certain people. Anything that might cost a little money, and we're talking about a budget of $2 million a year at this point, is a concern. And then I think there's legitimate concerns, as we mentioned before. Well, what does this group do? Is it infringing on our responsibility as members of Congress to make decisions? And the answer is no from our perspective. It's advisory. And then furthermore, I think there's some people who would say, well, what's this consensus council? Does it mean that, you know, if I'm a true believer on something, am I going to have to get watered down? Are people inherently going to have to compromise things they don't want to compromise? That's not part of the design, but it's an understandable concern. And I will tell you, I used to direct an advocacy group on the issue of hunger in America. I did that for 12 years. And I think if I hadn't really understood the principles of consensus building and conflict resolution, I would have been very skeptical about being brought into a process where I might have to agree to things or feel obligated to agree to things I thought violated fundamental principles I held. So I think there's an educational process we have to continue to undertake to have people understand this well and get comfortable with this idea. It's quite foreign to a lot of people in terms of how Capitol Hill now operates.
Now, consensus councils exist in North Dakota and Montana. Anywhere else at the state level right now?
At the state level, no. There's at least one local consensus council in California, but there are a whole series of state-level organizations on a continuum that do this kind of work. That is, that use conflict resolution and consensus building in public policy. Some do it within state governmental agencies or working with them. Some work with the courts. So there's a whole continuum of organizations across the country that use these processes. And at the national level, and I suspect at the state level as well, although I'm not as familiar with that, there's something called negotiated rulemaking, which certain federal agencies employ on certain issues. They actually bring stakeholders to the table and try to get a negotiation going. They don't call it consensus building. Rather than just have the agency decide based upon comments what a rule ought to be, what a regulation ought to be, they actually have people sit at the table and talk to each other. And there's been a fairly strong record of success using negotiated rulemaking. So the point is that there's a whole variety of related approaches that are being used with increasing success in terms of using real communication and cooperative problem solving to deal with difficult public policy issues.
How important is it to get for this to be a legitimate funded program of the government for it to even exist and to be effective? I mean, since it's not a formal part of the decision-making process in a legal sense, it would be an advisory process. Suppose a nonprofit organization were to just create this and say, here it is, at your disposal, send your stakeholders, and we'll spit out some consensus. Would Congress utilize it? You know, is this something that must be a legitimately law, so to speak?
Well, it's a great question, and actually we've considered all different kinds of models, but it was the considered judgment of our task force, including several former members of Congress, that for Congress to really to trust something, they needed to have some stewardship of it. And it's been my experience and very important as we deliberated that Congress knew that it would look at annual appropriations level, could control it. Congress had a role in appointing the board. In fact, Congress appoints 2/3 of the board. That there would be annual reporting back to Congress. I think what we're trying to do is thread a needle here. We both want to be wholly accountable to Congress and be of service to Congress, yet also be enough independent so we're not subject to the political ups and downs every year. So it would be a private organization that could raise private money in addition to public money, but would be closely tied and accountable to Congress. And the feeling was, this is yet to be tested, certainly a private nonprofit could try to operate this way, but I think the response is basically going to be, well, who are these people and how can we trust them and how do we know they're accountable and how do we know they're going to stay, commit to the principles they mentioned? And part of the answer is that, okay, Congress, you're going to get to appoint the board of directors and they're going to make sure that whatever principles you care about are carried out, or else you can change the board or you can close them down. So we think that was a very heartfelt feeling of our task force, our U.S. Consensus Council task force, that we needed to have an official sanction by Congress, or else we really wouldn't be utilized or wouldn't be as effective, wouldn't be listened to.
Mm-hmm. Now, what kind of people are on this task force?
Well, it's a great group of people. They range from, as I mentioned, former Governor Mark Roscoe and Dan Glickman, who was Secretary of Agriculture for President Clinton. Harris Wofford, the former senator from Pennsylvania and also the former director of AmeriCorps. Dennis Ross, the former chief Middle East negotiator for the United States for years, working for Democratic and Republican administrations on the Middle East. There's a woman, Janet Mullins Grissom, who is a vice president of Ford Motor Company, but formerly was an assistant secretary under Jim Baker at State Department. And there's a cross-section of additional people who are, I think, smart about public policy and understand conflict resolution. So we purposely try to get a cross-section politically and experientially and even geographically to some extent to make sure that we had put together something that would work for people in a whole variety of circumstances.
So I'd like to back up a little bit and take a closer look at what a consensus process really looks like. You know, how does this differ from task force or committee on, you know, fill in the blank? What is fundamentally unique about what a consensus council would look like in terms of you know, how they take on an issue. I mean, at a very, very micro level, you know, what does it look like? Does everybody walk into the room and sit around a round table and follow Robert's rules of order? Or is this something where people can do virtually, you know, submitting, you know, papers and, you know, kind of debate the issue back and forth? What does it, you know, what really is this process? What does it look like? How does it work?
Well, I can say definitively that it's not clear how it's going to work because I think it's going to depend on the circumstances. Mm-hmm. And frankly, one of the things we want to make sure we do is not say there's going to be one cookie-cutter approach. This is a field mm-hmm. that's evolving, and different strategies will work for different people and on different issues. There may be an issue where if you only have four or five stakeholders in the room, they're the ones that are the most important. And if you bring in enough other intelligence and information, you may be able to make great headway. There may be another issue where you need 50 people because the issues are so diverse and so many people have points of view that you need to manage that process. Here's what I think the fundamentals are, and it's different than the normal process that I've been part of, and I've been parts of dozens of pieces of legislation, either as a staffer or as a head of a public interest group. The first thing that makes it unique is, first, there's an effort to include as wide an array of voices as you possibly can. Doesn't mean that everyone who cares about it gets in the room, but you need to make sure that the groups are representative of all the key perspectives. And so there's a process of figuring out, well, who really needs to be in the room? Both who is it who has the influence and knowledge and power that if they reached agreement, it would be noteworthy? And who is it if you exclude it has mm-hmm. enough power to spoil the deal, to get in the way? So you need to. So that's not something people think about. Usually they think about, well, let's round up all the people we agree with. Let's build the largest coalition we can have. And if we get enough power together, we'll win. Or if we put the right information together, you know, or we touch the right hearts, we'll get it done. So this process first says, okay, who needs to be, whose intelligence and perspective needs to be at the table? Secondly, a key element for most of the practitioners I've talked to and the processes I've observed is, you take some time to actually build some trust amongst the parties. What you try to do is get people to talk to each other as full human beings, not just as one position to another. And I think out of that comes a discussion of values and people's interests that are often illuminating. And frankly, you create an atmosphere where people really can talk to each other fully. Once you've done that, and you've also gathered the research that puts you on a common factual understanding and reach agreements on what the facts are, and there may be some disagreements, but generally you want to have an understanding, you have people reach a common understanding of what the real facts are, then you try to build agreements. You try to see where you can go which represent true common ground amongst people. And what I've been told is that in some instances, once people really understand where everyone else is coming from, they can even help each other find answers that work for each other. You know, it might be someone who disagrees with someone else, let's say, about, you know, government aid to religious institutions. But they'll be clever enough to know, hey, you know, if I like this idea, but it's not going to flow with you. It's not going to sell with your constituency, so we have to work together to find something else. So that's the next process of hopefully curiosity, hopefully respect, hopefully looking to see where the agreements are that might be able to carry the day for different constituencies. And if once you build those agreements, and then it's a matter of making those recommendations to Congress and working to implement them. So it's fundamentally more of a cooperative kind of relationship, even though there may be intense debates and rivalries within the room. There may be anger. There may even be people who don't like each other in the room. But the model is about bringing people to understand and hopefully respect different points of view and see if there's some answers that actually work for virtually everybody.
Now, there's nothing actually preventing current members of Congress from coming to agreement on certain issues, from trying to work collaboratively. But, you know, for some reason, that's just not the norm. kind of debate-oriented adversarial approach certainly is the norm. But what does the role of a facilitator really play here? You know, for instance, if you didn't have a trained kind of mediator, facilitator type person helping coordinate or guide this process, do you think those stakeholders who come to this table, metaphorical or not, would naturally be predisposed to a collaborative process, or would they come to the table with their debate cards in hand?
Well, I don't think they'd come to the table to begin with. So first of all, let me say something. I think probably there's a lot more work done collaboratively in Congress than the public realizes. because it's the hot button issues that get attention, and they're important issues. And certainly, if you ask members of Congress, every decade they say this is the worst decade ever. It always seems to get worse in terms of people's relationship, but people do hearken back to days when people from different points of view and different parties would play cards together and travel with each other, and you know, the differences weren't as, you know, the interest groups weren't as built up. So I think there is a lot of collaborative problem solving. It's just that that doesn't get a lot of press and attention. But beyond that, I think one of the things I should say, and I come to this out of public policy. I'm not a conflict resolution professional. I come from having worked on three congressional staffs and run an advocacy group. And I come out of sort of that background, although my own personal style has always been much more common groundish. There are people with real skills and knowledge about how to bring people together. And that's part of people. Some of those people get trained here at George Mason University. And there are a lot of other schools and other people who are schooled by life. This isn't just about people of goodwill. I mean, I met with a staffer on the House side about a year ago, and she said to me, you know, I'm a skillful staffer. I know how to get people to come to an agreement. And then she proceeded to tell me about all the fights and arguments she's been in all the time. And frankly, there is a knowledge. It isn't just about, you know, getting people together and hugging each other and singing kumbaya around a table. There actually are concrete skills about how one builds trust in the room, how one begins to distinguish your interests from your positions, how one begins to build a common understanding of the facts, and how one skillfully gets people to look for alternatives that may work for everybody. As I say, I'm not the practitioner who does that, but I'm aware and have seen in action people of great skill who know how to get past the petty personal debates that go on or the egos that are in the room or suggest ways to allow people to understand how they can win without the other person having to lose. And if you get, as we hope to do, the very best practitioners in the country to work on the issues that the U.S. Consensus Council will take on, I think the odds of being successful will go up dramatically.
You're listening to Conflict on WGMU, coming from George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia, on 650 AM and George Mason University Cable Channel 22, and worldwide on WGMUradio.com. And today we are speaking with Rob Fersh. He's the director of the National Consensus Initiative, and we're hearing about plans to create what would be known as the National Consensus Council, a place where stakeholders of important national issues could come together and seek consensus on issues as an advisement process for the U.S. Congress. Did I get that right, Rob?
Pretty close.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And so next thing, I guess, to look at would be I'd be interested in maybe some more examples, if you have any in mind, and it doesn't necessarily have to be a consensus council per se, but can you think of any other examples where people have come together on an issue where at the outset it seemed like there couldn't be any agreement between them, and in fact they did find a meaningful agreement?
Well, there are countless examples. There are practitioners who do this all the time at the local level, whether it's where to place the incinerator in the neighborhood. I have a colleague who helped resolve a problem in Montgomery County a few months ago where people couldn't agree on a parking issue, and he got people to sit down and do cooperative problem solving. There's an organization called Search for Common Ground in Washington, D.C., which pulled together people who had different points of view on the president's so-called faith-based initiative, the issue of to what extent and when should government money go to community and faith-based institutions that provide social services. And while they didn't reach agreement on some of the toughest principled issues, they did find a series of recommendations that took the debate much further along than any of them had anticipated and became a major part of the legislation that moved through the Senate on this issue. I think that issue may still be alive in terms of ultimate legislation. But the truth is there are dozens and dozens of examples, and there are wonderful organizations throughout the Washington area and around the country who have skilled practitioners who do this kind of work. There's a group called Resolve in Washington. There's a group called CDR based in Boulder. A series of others. I'm just blanking on other names. The Keystone Center, the Meridian Institute. A whole series of organizations have great skill, and the Consensus Building Institute out of Cambridge, Massachusetts. People work all over the world using these processes with great success, and there are literally dozens of successful examples of how these skills get employed.
Just a ballpark question, or I guess I'm looking for a ballpark answer of this kind of random question. How many members, elected members of Congress, would you guess actually are aware of those types of processes?
How many people are specifically aware of those
processes? It's kind of a philosophical question.
I would guess maybe, you know, small, or maybe it's 10%. But for instance, Dan Glickman, who was a member of Congress for many terms, resonated with this because he helped sponsor the legislation to create alternative dispute resolution processes in the federal agencies. He did this 20 years ago. He also helped co-sponsored the House bill to set up the U.S. Institute of Peace. So I think there are some people who get this, who understand it, and appreciate it, and have some sense of the field. I mean, it has seeped in. Alternative dispute resolution has seeped in within businesses and unions and other places, and I think there is some appreciation of that. It's not as widespread as you would like. I'd also say that there are a number of other members of Congress who, just by their very nature, are bridge builders and operate that way. Mm-hmm. And I had the pleasure of working on the Senate side for Senator Pat Leahy 20 years ago, and we formed a very strong working relationship with Senator Bob Dole on the nation's nutrition programs. And there really was a sense of, okay, we're going to talk it through and find common ground. And although it wasn't a broad consensus process, the chairman of the committee at that point was Jesse Helms, and we didn't necessarily get him on board. But Senator Leahy and Senator Dole often could find out common ground solutions because they were amenable to it. Similarly, on the House side, I think it's an important lesson. I had the honor of working for then-Representative Leon Panetta, who chaired the Nutrition Subcommittee in the House of Representatives in the mid-1980s. Dan Glickman was on that subcommittee. Well, one of the best things we ever did was, in the beginning of our term, we went and held some field hearings, and the ranking Republican member, the late Bill Emerson of Missouri, very decent man, but who had we thought probably would not vote with us on anything. We went on a series of field hearings. Leon and Bill got to know each other. They built trust. They saw the issues firsthand. They saw what the problems were. And for years, they sponsored bipartisan legislation that was stronger because each of them was contributing to that solution. And so they were, by nature, people who I think could move beyond their own ideology to perhaps be a little more pragmatic or build bridges to others. And there are many, many people who I think are skilled in doing that. It doesn't mean that this is the only way to do it or the only right way to do it. But I'm just saying that even if people aren't formally aware of consensus building as a skill set, there are many who actually practice it and are very effective legislators because they naturally have some aptitude to do that.
Could you ever imagine a consensus council process that actually did involve the elected members of Congress themselves as participants?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I think the consensus council process pretty much doesn't envision that. But I could imagine, let's say, getting a call from, let's say, the chief of staff to a committee who's saying, you know, we're having a series of staff conversations, or the members are going to have a private caucus on some issues. And can you help us out with some skills about how we have a different kind of cooperation in the room? They could come to us. They can come to anybody to do that. But it seems to me if we develop some reputation for expertise and skill, that whatever lessons we have about how to conduct good meetings that bring good results that involve different perspectives, we'd make ourselves available. It seems to me that we or others could do, if there was interest, do training on how to do that. There are a lot of people out there already who do great training. And I think one of the things we'd want to do is bring some greater visibility to the whole field and let those in the field who've got skills come in and contribute that in any way it can to help Congress create more effective, wiser public policy.
You know, I've always wondered what does a decision-making process typically look like in Congress? I mean, we have this ideal, I guess, of members of Congress standing around in these giant chambers and, you know, discussing the merits of issues and convincing each other or, you know, persuading each other back and forth. And I was kind of disillusioned when I visited the Capitol about a year ago and got passes to the House chambers and went up there on the balcony and, you know, went to see our great Congress before me, you know, debating some important issue. And I noticed there were about five or six people in the room total, maybe two representatives and then some staff people. And they were talking about basketball, I think, some nothing to do with any important kind of issue in the United States that I was aware of. I didn't know college basketball was an issue of national congressional importance. But they were in talk. I think somebody had just won the college basketball playoffs, and they were kind of congratulating that team. They're at the mic, and, you know, the stenographer's is sitting there recording it all. And what was that all about?
Well, first of all, for some of us, basketball is a religion. It's very important. Look, the floor of Congress serves a lot of purposes, and there are times when there's sort of downtime from debate, and people want to go on the record about certain things. And, of course, with the advent of C-SPAN and others, sometimes there's some grandstanding. But normally it's also a place where people recognize and celebrate what's going on in the world, positive or negative. What I'd say to you, Sean, I think, and this is more of a political science or civics lesson, is that, you know, the most members can't come to the floor to hear every issue debated all the time, or they couldn't get their other work done. In many cases, the issues are sufficiently complex they have to rely on the leadership of people in their party or people they trust from other committees who are knowledgeable about issues. On the huge issues that are like earth-shattering, then more and more people will come to the floor and participate in debate. But it's really hard in the House with 435 members to have the real issues come out in a way that's compelling and people can really listen to and vote based on that. I think sometimes it does happen. It maybe happened more in the past. The Senate was more known for that. I was just recently reading.
Well, of course, they had their 30-hour talk-a-thon last week.
Yeah. Well, you know, not everyone's going to sit there and listen to it. But I guess what I'm saying to you is there's a lot of work that's done behind the scenes. Some of it has to be delegated to staff. Some's done in the committee on some huge issues, sometimes 20, 30, 40,